Committee will come to order and we'll start off with a roll call.
Chair Senator Christman?
Here.
Johnson Rod?
Here.
Representative Kempinick?
Here.
Wyler?
Here.
Ms. Sharp?
Here.
Mr. Hardmider?
Here.
And Commissioner Fong is on speakerphone.
Yes, here.
Welcome, Commissioner. We have a quorum. And I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes unless there are corrections that need to be made.
I'll move.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Any other discussion on the motion to approve the minutes as printed? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion carries. And we'll go into our 135 agenda item and hear from a representative of the State Investment Board.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Darren Schultz. I'm interim CIO for North Dakota Retirement. With the North Dakota Retirement and Investment Office. Today I'd like to provide just a very brief update on the investment history and returns of the Budget Stabilization Fund and the Legacy Fund. Did everyone get a copy of the slide deck?
Lay out on the...
Let me grab you one.
Yeah.
This isn't the one that can be 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You got one.
Yep.
Well, before you go into that, did you see the agenda item on the recruitment of an investment officer?
I didn't realize there was a request for the...
My apologies. Would you be prepared to do that? Just a minute. Madam Treasurer?
Lieutenant Governor Wrigley asked me if I would be willing to step in on his behalf at your request.
Very good. That's what we were looking forward to at 135. So if let's do that first, Darren, and then we'll move to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm State Treasurer Kelly Schmidt. Lieutenant Governor Wrigley had been asked to come and give you an update as where we are in the process of bringing on a full-time Chief Investment Officer. At this time, the board is still examining different options as to how we proceed. We've been looking at the business model of the Retirement Investment Office as it relates to the State Investment Board and the relationship between the Executive Director and the Chief Investment Officer. And I think the board will be continuing, or I know the board will be continuing those discussions tomorrow, and we'll probably come to some resolution as we move forward, at which time we'll decide if we're going to do an RFP for a headhunting firm, or if we will be making some decisions as it relates to the interim position, moving that to a permanent position, and the board will hopefully tomorrow make some determination. Any questions?
Any questions for the treasurer?
Thank you.
Thank you for coming down. We would have grilled the Lieutenant Governor if he'd have been here.
That's what he was afraid of, Mr. Chairman, 3 seconds.
Okay. Now, Darren, if you would come back up and we'll move to the 140.
In your slide deck, let's start on page 2, which shows a investment history and returns of the Legacy Fund. This is data through September 30th of 2012. In fiscal year 2012, the Legacy Fund, since its initial funding in September, took in approximately $397 million in transfers. Through the course of the fiscal year, we saw a net increase in assets of $2.3 million, ending the fiscal year at approximately $399 million. At the beginning of fiscal year 2013, this reflects one quarter through September. We took in transfers of approximately $139 million, and we recognize a net increase in assets of $3.7 million, and we ended the first fiscal quarter with total assets of $541 million. I'll refer to the bottom of
Darren. So, for 2013, for one quarter, there's a 0.83% annual rate of return, but for 2012, it's not available because it's a partial year, I don't understand that. Can't you still calculate it out to what it would be per year?
That would reflect the partial year. We don't have a full year. It's not a full fiscal year of reflected since it's only three quarters. That's why it shows just a partial.
Well, for fiscal year 2013, it's only a one quarter. We got that one figured out.
That's a one quarter return.
That's the one quarter return.
Mr. Chair.
But,
yeah, so we can do it for one quarter, but we can't do it for three quarters?
Well,
I mean, it's probably not so important. I'm curious. I don't understand why it would.
We have a one-year track record now, and at the bottom it shows a cumulative return, which is also equivalent to the one-year return since it's a one-year track record of. The total return over that full year is 1.86% versus our policy benchmark, which is the Barclays Capital Government 1-3 year index of 0.43%. So that is a one-year cumulative and annualized one-year return.
Representative Kaepernick, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman,
so Darren, the way it figures out then, the 396 should have been a little over a 1% then? Because you got an average annualized of 1.86, and you've averaged on the last quarter 0.83.
It would, a back of the envelope, it would be approximately 1% over that three-quarter period, roughly.
Okay, let me understand. How come it's only 2.3, though, for the, you know, what you got net increase? Or was there some costs involved in that to get?
That reflects price appreciation and income. So that is a net increase in assets based on performance of the portfolio. Mm-hmm. That's above and beyond the principal, the cash transfers that were made from the State Treasurer's Office. Is that your question?
Well, yeah. Well,
I remember at the beginning of that, there was very little in there.
Yeah.
So it wasn't.
Well, no, I know. So basically, what this 3.7 then is coming out is taking the 3.96, and it'd be more of what you're to get to your net increase for this last quarter, then it'd be more of the 3.7. You see where I'm coming from? Where did the 2.3 come from?
That is the appreciation and income above and beyond the actual transfer amount.
Yeah.
That's a total return.
Of the 3.96. Well, no, I know it's the interest earned and stuff on it. It is. See, what I'm trying to figure out is this last quarter, we've earned a 3.7. But that doesn't associate. It's basically the 3.7. Came from just the 138. See, that's what I'm trying to figure out is how. Yeah. Do you understand how? How come we didn't earn as much? That I know it started out slow. We kind of sat on it for a while, but we should have had.
Well, we really
quarters.
The 3.7 million is return. Is return on the whole. For the $500 million that was in there during that quarter,
and we didn't begin to invest in the short duration fixed income mandates with Babson and J.P. Morgan until the beginning of the year.
Okay.
So,
yeah,
that
because it was in December, I think it wasn't.
Yeah. So that quarter, the last quarter, calendar quarter of 2011, it was really just beginning to be transitioned into short-term bonds. So that's why if you compare return over that period versus what we're having now, it's a little different.
Okay, sure. Continue.
Okay. The portfolio, we did outperform our policy benchmark. Both J.P. Morgan and Babson over the course of the quarter turned in some relatively good performance with 0.83% net return versus the policy benchmark. I just want to make a few comments just regarding the market environment in the last quarter, first quarter of this fiscal year. As everyone knows, the portfolio is 100% fixed income. And in the last quarter, we saw a flight to quality in which investors migrated over to, from safe haven assets into spread sectors, such as corporate bonds and mortgage-backed securities. And as a result, these sectors outperformed treasuries, duration equivalent treasuries. And the treasuries ended the quarter with yields basically unchanged. The two-year treasury over the course of the quarter fell 7 basis points to 0.23%. And our managers have been able to outperform duration equivalent treasuries through exposure to corporate bonds and mortgage-backed securities, namely. On the following page, unless there are more questions, is a summary of the Budget Stabilization Fund, data through September 30 of 2012. Over the course of fiscal year 2012, we saw transfers of $61.4 million, a net increase in assets of approximately $7.9 million, and we ended the fiscal year of 2012 with total assets of $395 million. Achieving a net return over the course of the fiscal year of 1.67%. In the first quarter of 2013 fiscal year, we saw a net increase in assets of approximately $3.4 million, and we ended the first quarter of our fiscal year with total assets of $398.4 million. And at the very bottom, you can see the cumulative return inception to date, which is September 2005. We achieved cumulative return of 18.95%, and the annualized return over the seven-year period is 2.51%, which compares favorably to the Barclays Government 1-to-3-year index of 1.95%. And lastly, on
Ms. Farab, I don't expect you to give things away that are in the process regarding the governor's budget proposal. But is there anything that causes you discomfort here as far as the liquidity of it or anything that you're aware of coming down the pike that we should be addressing regarding the Budget Stabilization Fund?
Mr. Chairman, no, I'm comfortable with this. I think it's fine.
On the very last slide, I put together a graph which will kind of be a good segue into our discussions with RV Kuhn's, a summary of year-to-date monthly transfers that we've experienced over the course of the calendar year. As you can see, generally we've seen transfers range from approximately $40 million up to, we had a deposit of $49.7 million in July, and in October, Treasurer Schmidt transferred $53.9 million into the legacy fund, which is the highest monthly transfer to date. And as you can see, we ended the first fiscal year quarter at $541.4 million. And Mr. Chairman,
the November transfer hasn't been made yet, but with the October transfer that's not on here, even before the November transfer goes in, we're just about at 600 then right now, right?
That's correct. Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, that concludes my comments, unless there are any further questions.
I'm sort of looking around you at the treasurer. Do we know what the amount is yet, or is that not public known yet? Okay. Any other questions for Darren on this update of the numbers? Okay, let's move into, thank you, Darren, and we'll move into the 150 item with whoever's going to speak to us from RV Kuhn's and Associates.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Thank you for your time today. And my name is Josh Keevan with RV Kuhn's and Associates. I have with me my colleagues, Ron Clotter and John McLaughlin.
And just for the three of you, if you switch off and who's answering a question or something like that, would you state your name so that our tape recording has it and it makes it easier to follow up and do minutes and those sorts of things. So.
Absolutely. Mr. Mr. Chairman, thank you. The first thing I'd like to say is, you know, thank you for this opportunity. This is a very exciting project. We're very excited to be a part of it and working with you on this. It's not very often that you get to be part of something that's this exciting as far as, you know, the building out of the asset allocation of a new permanent fund. It does bring me back to about 13 years ago. This is about where Wyoming was in the development of their permanent funds, and we've helped them through that pretty extensively over the last 13 years or so. And so we do have some experience with going through this kind of a process. We put together a document, and I'll just pause for a minute to make sure everybody has a copy of that. It looks like you do. Essentially just to be a guide in the discussion. We've done some research already on your state constitution, century code, and investment policy, and you'll see some references to those documents and what those documents say in our presentation. It's really just intended to be a guide for this discussion. We're really here today to hear your views on the Legacy Fund and its mission and its objectives, and to take away whatever is important and whatever that we need to hear from you relative to those, and so that we can make sure that this is a successful project. There's really, we've divided the discussion into really five components. The first three are really sort of key components of the analysis. The revenue coming into the fund, the asset allocation or how that money is invested, and the spending, which is money coming out of the fund, and then lastly a few questions on governance decision making and how we can best support you in this project. Mr. Chairman, I'll pause there to see if there's any questions so far.
I don't think so. Go ahead.
Thank you. If you flip to page two, the title at the top is Fund Revenue, and first of all, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the information that you did send us already. A lot of it covered a few of these questions that we have on really trying to help us get good estimates for revenue into the fund. That has been actually very helpful, and I think will make this part of the conversation perhaps a little bit briefer. A few things that we would perhaps ask on this page would be, are there, beyond the revenue forecast, you know, that include assumptions for spot prices for West Texas crude, production volumes, beyond those types of forecasts and looking at different scenarios for what that could look like, is there anything that the advisory board would say to us is really important for us to consider in terms of the revenue that might come into these funds in future years?
Reverend Kampanek.
Mr. Chairman and John, right?
Josh,
okay. You're John, Josh, okay. What's probably going to happen this session is there's probably going to be some change in how the gross production tax is allocated out to local political subdivisions. And that, so that will, it might not be a lot impact to the to this, but the way last session we put some caveats in this here that the local political subdivisions do not participate in this legacy fund. So there could be some incomes that are going to be adjusted coming in, you know, the numbers that we're using, you know, it's been ratcheting up steadily, you know, and stuff on it, but it might flatten out somewhat if that, and truthfully, I don't know what the numbers are going to be, but there probably will be some changes in amounts coming in after this next session is over with. So that's something that we're going to make you aware of right now. It is.
Right. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
The other factor that could change things dramatically are regulations.
Yeah.
There's regulations that could, you know, squash that oil industry in a hurry. So the things that we just don't know.
May I ask what the expected timing might be of the potential changes with this next session?
My guess is, unless they put it under emergency clause, it'd be June of next year. Okay. The end of June is when the next fiscal year starts.
is when they probably wind up, that would probably wind up changing some of that. It would. I don't.
We've talked about the impacts to this a little bit about how it would, because this is just one side of the, this is coming off the 5% side of it, so the 6.5 wouldn't be touched. And there's a graph that you can read through. It's on Headwaters. There's a Headwaters site. It's out of Missoula, Montana, that did a study for the oil and gas producing counties out there, and they've got a graph of how this all flows through and stuff on it. And I think the council could give you a graph too of how, but what we're talking about is one side of this, but it will impact how that flows through and stuff on it. It will. So there's, you know, what we see today might change on what happens with that side of it.
Representative Lawler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question, after listening to Representative Kempenick, my question, Josh, is not for you, for Representative Kempenick, is I don't quite understand how the revenue of the legacy fund would be affected by any change that the legislature might make. I mean, that's, the legislature cannot make any changes to the revenue for the legacy fund that was set in. The people voted on that. That's part of the Constitution. So can you explain to me how that...
Yeah, because when you read through, it's 30%. There isn't a dollar amount of what, it's 30%, and it got changed last session that the counties come out before anything the state gets. So when the treasurer, when it shows up at the treasurer's office, the local political subdivisions go first before anything the state gets.
Alan, just Alan elaborate on it a little bit, if you know anything about any proposals that are...
Well, I don't know about the proposals, but I know, you know, the changes that were made last session did hold the counties harmless, but the legacy fund won't be affected by any of those changes. What that did was it made the state share, the general fund, take the hit rather than the counties or cities. So, but really, the legacy fund won't be affected by any proposals that come forward either.
Okay.
Because that comes right off the very top.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Continue, Josh.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I think to kind of this general, to the degree that there's uncertainty about future revenues, we do envision not only building a base case based on reasonable projections, but also looking at multiple scenarios, and with an emphasis on more adverse scenarios, which would be, in your example, regulation that flows off, it cuts off the flow of revenue. And so we would think that would be an important part of looking at this, would be what happens when, if we have this happen. You know, there's definitely going to be some scenario analysis that we would envision as an important part of this front end of the process. As it relates to revenue, one question we did have, and I apologize, this wasn't in our earlier questions, is there any hedging activity that the state engages in with regards to spot prices that would potentially have any impact on the fund's revenue?
Nothing that I'm aware of. I don't see how we would be involved in that, and okay. I'm not seeing anyone else that seems to yeah. know of anything. Yeah. So continue. Yeah.
Thank you. I think if there are no questions on or additional inputs on the revenue, I think a much sort of media part of the discussion is on page 3, the asset allocation component of this. We've inserted here a couple of statements. First, from the Legacy Fund Investment Policy Statement, which describes the mission as the primary mission of the Legacy Fund is to preserve the real inflation-adjusted purchasing power of the monies deposited into the fund. And that is a very long-term oriented statement, a very endowment-oriented type of investment goal. We've also inserted in here a statement from the North Dakota Century Code, Section 21, was, provides that the goal of investment for the legacy fund is principal preservation while maximizing total return. So there seems to be potentially sort of this tug and pull between safety preservation and preserving the long-term real purchasing power of the assets. And the preserving the real purchasing power of the assets component is really heavily dependent on the spending side of the equation. If nothing is spent, for example, then that job is actually fairly easily and can be accomplished through relatively safe investments. If the spending is closer to the maximum, which as we understand it is 15% per biennium plus the any earnings on top of that, then that job of preserving the real purchasing power is much more challenging and requires a very different type of risk profile for the invested assets. So to a degree, it's difficult to separate this discussion on asset allocation from the spending discussion. But as a starting point, we were really hoping to engage in a dialogue about the board's, advisory board's views as it relates to appropriate levels of return objectives, risk, and liquidity.
Well, I think just for a starter, we all know that if future legislatures and governors decide to spend 15% of the principal and all the earnings, then you can't earn enough to hold the spending power. So, you know, I mean, that kind of a decision-making process would just make it impossible. If they're going to spend all the earnings, then you can't hold on. So that's a given that, you know, if spending gets carried away, you can't achieve that goal. Mr. Hardmeyer, did you?
Yeah. Josh, I wondered if you are contemplating a asset allocation that would change based on a time frame, so that until 2017 you look at an asset allocation of X, Y, and Z because no principal can be spent, and then subsequently changing that based on what happens or can happen in 2017. Is that something that you are thinking about here?
Mr. Chairman, the asset allocation decision, from in our experience, is generally something that's best revisited periodically. And mm-hmm. Typically the way that process works with our clients is that at least on an every 3-year cycle, some clients prefer to revisit that more frequently than that, but at least every 3 years, that asset allocation decision tends to be revisited really for, you know, the point that you're making is that circumstances change. You know, it might be economic circumstances that change, it may be decisions about spending that change, but you know, generally when you set an asset allocation target, it is a long-term decision, but it's not one that you completely set and walk away from. We do recommend that's something that gets revisited every couple of years.
So you're looking for guidance right now regarding an asset allocation. Is that the stage, or do you have more building up to that point?
Mr. Chairman, if the board has views on asset allocation as it relates to general risk profiles, concerns regarding specific asset classes, or any concerns or questions regarding modeling process, we would look for those views.
Chairman, I'm Ron Clutter. Maybe one way to frame the thinking, if we start with where we are today, it's 100% fixed income, and we look at the time horizon, I think maybe one way to start the discussion, since this is our first meeting with you, is your relative comfort with assets that are not risk-free. In other words, right now you're all in very conservative fixed income. And I think what Josh was alluding to, some of the comments in your material refer to more of an endowment-like model, which would certainly have risky assets in it. So the first part of the dialogue, from our perspective, is can we assume that the introduction of some risky assets, starting with equities, is an acceptable path for us to go down or not? And if not, you know, that certainly will factor into what our range of options is in the modeling process. That's generally where we'd like to start the discussion.
Representative Kempinick?
What kind of percentages were we've had some come in, last year, and they're talking pretty high on equities and stuff, and what kind of, that's the whole thing, I think, is where this conversation is I think everybody understands that you need to have some risk to earn something back, although this climate doesn't seem to be rewarding much risk at all on it to a certain degree. That's been one of the, I think, been the crux of the problem here right now more of what, anyways, in my view, is more of a hedge against inflation, and you got into that a little bit with trying to protect your purchasing power, down the road here. And I think, that's kind of what, how to come up with that is, and without taking big risks on it, but yet still have something that it's worth doing, because if it gets too low, we may as well spend it today and use it. And that's been kind of the argument of the whole problem is to have something that it's building. I look at some of these other funds there's been some ups and downs, but a lot of them have been real slow to take off, and that's kind of that's why I think everybody's kind of struggling with is try to stay out of the risk as much as possible, but still look at some decent returns on it. And that's kind of why we wound up with what we did. It was simple for one thing, it didn't take a lot of management on it, and because I don't think we want to spend a lot on, if you get too carried away on management fees and stuff too. So,
Mr. Heidmeier.
Yeah, I don't know who wants to answer this question, but it does talk about our mission to preserve the real inflation-adjusted purchasing power. In your view, can we do this? Is that possible in today's environment without buying equities?
Mr. Chairman, the answer to that question would be it depends, and it depends on the spending. So, if nothing is spent, you might be able to achieve that with some allocation to high yield fixed income, higher yielding sectors of the fixed income market. When you factor in, though, the fact that earnings are going to be spent, you do have to start looking towards target rates of return that will likely require some equity exposure to achieve this goal of preserving real purchasing power.
Well, I'm going to say from my perspective, I'm skeptical about that ability, in the current environment. I think we're in a very, very risky environment. And I'm just going to throw this up for discussion, but I really think that this committee and whoever is on this committee in 4 years from now, if the criticism of the committee is that the return wasn't very good, that would not be a good thing, but it wouldn't be a critical thing. If the criticism of the committee in 4 years from now is that they squandered a whole bunch of money, many, many, many millions of dollars, that would be a critical thing. And I think then we would look back and say the committee members over the years had made some big mistakes. And if the criticism in 4 years is that there are terrible financial straits in the state and
that Legislative Assembly needs to spend 5 or 10 or 15% of this money, and there's not even that much left, then we have really failed. And so when we talk about asset allocation, it seems to me that, I mean, we've got a lot in the fixed incomes right now, but it seems to me that we need to be shooting for a time when we have at least 15% of this money available in cash or cash equivalents. And I know right now there's no significant rate of return on that, but you know, our bonds aren't going to have a very good rate of return either if interest rates start going up. And the equities that we buy aren't going to have a real great rate of return either if we go back into recession. So there's some risk in all of this. So to me, the starting point is that I think 15% of this has to be in cash and cash equivalents.
Well, that's, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kempinick?
I think the 15% is something that's, yeah, there's, and that's kind of a moving target too, because as it grows, 15% of what it is in 2017, so that's kind of a hard target to predict of what you leave out, though, too, it is. But that's, I think that's what we need, though, is a couple scenarios, you know, a couple or three scenarios put together of what you do, you know, with of how this is kind of structured, that to the 15% of what we kind of estimate will probably be, have to be accessible, you know, and that's just going to be the 85% that's left, I think, you know, then that's probably a different scenario that a person can work on. But I think that's part of what we need to.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Tyler. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is if someone could help me better understand why the 15% mark. I understand it's because of the legislative body's ability to spend up to 15%. That's not for another 4 years, but why is it so important that 15% of this fund be in cash or cash equivalents? In other words, you know, then it's got to be, I mean, do they have to access that money right away? I mean, they don't have to have it tomorrow. So I don't understand why the, and I don't have a, it doesn't matter either way whether 15% is in cash equivalents or not to me right now, but I don't understand why would it need to be in cash or cash equivalents. I mean, if the legislative body decides in 2017 session that they're going to spend 15% of the fund, and let's say the fund has $1 billion in it, the money, they don't need the money right away. It's not like it's the next day they need the money. So, you know, why does it have to be in cash or cash equivalents? I don't quite understand that.
Look at me.
No, I'm not looking at anybody. I'm looking at anybody that can help me understand that.
Maybe it will need to be right away. I don't know. I'm hoping, I'm confident that they're not going to need it. I'm hoping that they don't spend it when it's not needed. But if there's some sort of a crisis going on, maybe they do need it right away. What we do know is that in order to get the votes passed, to pass the constitutional amendment, we bought off on the fact, we put it in there that 15% was available to the 2017 session. And I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that 15% is available for the 2017 session. And if they put the emergency clause on something, then that's what they do.
But Mr. Chairman, if we were to go down that road and put two points, number one, if we don't have to make it available, if we do make it available, it might be that much easier for the legislative body to say, well, they've made it available, let's go spend it. Number one. Number two is if they do decide to spend 15% of the principal and they do it on an emergency clause type of situation, they still have 3 or 4 months before they need the money. They can't pass a law one day and the next week say, well, we got to have the money. I just don't understand why it needs to be accessible so automatically right then and there. I mean, we would have at least up to 3 or 4 months, I would think, if they did decide to spend the money, which I hope they don't, but.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hagmeyer.
Well, I would guess that any asset allocation model that you're looking at would provide some sort of liquidity that would, you know, solve the issues that the chairman is concerned about, that you would easily be able to convert any of those asset categories to cash if you needed to. Sometimes you might take a little bit of a hit, but so I guess I agree with Representative Wilder. I'm not quite sure I understand, you know, to have 15% in cash and equivalents when any kind of asset allocation model, I would guess, would have, you know, some sort of easy transition to liquidity.
Mr. Chairman, this has been helpful to sort of focus in on the liquidity aspect, and what we are hearing is that this liquidity is important, and we would agree with that. You do want to plan for the adverse case because you don't want there to be surprises in this portfolio, and we understand that. And I think we can help through this process to help for that component that would be first for liquidity to help understand what some different options are and what the liquidity features of those different options would be, whether it's cash or short-term bonds or something in that range, and what the potential pros and cons would be to different liquidity vehicles.
Because am I incorrect in this? When we talk about, okay, we can invest in other things and make them liquid at the time, but if they're stocks and they're in the tank at the time, we're in big trouble. To the extent that we keep it in bonds that are going to have less risk than that, isn't right now somewhat risky with bonds anyways? Because, I mean, I don't see a real big chance of interest rates going down. And if interest rates come up, those bonds aren't going to do very well, correct?
Mr. Chairman, correct. Yes, there is an inverse relationship between rates and bond price levels. And there's a wide spectrum of, to your first point, you're correct that part of the liquidity discussion is the potential that you'd have to sell it at a loss. And in fixed income, there's really two primary sources of risk. There's interest rate exposure and there's credit risk exposure. And but there's a wide spectrum of choices within that, and you know, I think we can help you understand what those choices are in this process.
Representative Wilder.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. You know, just to maybe wrap this up, I don't really have a problem so much with having money be available right away through cash or cash equivalents or what have you. My only concern with it would be giving the legislative body another reason to say, hey, there's more money that's easily available. You know, the last thing the legislative bodies in North Dakota need is a reason to spend more money. But if we do get into a situation, Mr. Chairman, where we need money, where we really are in trouble, and $150 million, again, saying there's $1 billion in this fund in 2017, $150 million would be the most we could access in that biennium. And if we get into a situation where this is our last resort, and we really have to have it out of this fund, then this state's in a whole lot more trouble than this fund is ever going to help us with. So I would hope that we would be a little careful about putting everything, or putting that much in cash and cash equivalents. Thank you.
Ms. Sharp?
I guess I would just go back to the principle that there's something to be said about a balanced portfolio. And right now, when we have it all in bonds, it's not balanced. And so we're just dependent on what happens in the bond market. So I think, I think we should consider some equities just so that we have a more balanced approach, so that if something does tank, not everything's going to tank. And then also keep in mind that if we do need to access 15%, we have different places to take that money from.
I'm sorry, were you done?
I was asking.
Did you have a response to that?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Is, outside of, the potential for regulations or something like that that are out of our control here, or the spending potential that is also out of our control, if when you're doing long-term institutional investing, am I wrong? And somewhere along I picked this up, is a 60-40 split between equities and bonds kind of a starting point rule of thumb, that, and then you deviate according to other intricacies of the particular fund, or is that not a standard at all?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, we would agree that that's kind of historically been the benchmark and the starting point for a lot of, long-term portfolios. 60-40 may be a little bit more of what you've historically seen in the pension world. In the endowment world, it's maybe been a little bit more towards 70-30. But I think there are some other variables here that that are significant that might alter you off of that kind of an allocation.
Elaborate.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we I think would help tie the conversation together is the concept of time horizon. And actually, the pension versus endowment is a good example. The reason the average endowment has more in equities is, in general, they have a longer time horizon than a pension. And then other assets with a shorter time horizon.
Just a minute. The endowment has the longer horizon?
Right. Right.
And so they tend to be more towards 70-30?
More aggressive, right. So there, if you think of a university endowment, typically the mindset is this entity will be here in perpetuity, so we're investing for the very long term. So when you see many institutions that have large investments in private equity and hedge funds and real estates, those are often the endowments with a very long time horizon. And the discussion is the concept's very germane here, because when we talk about your dual objectives of principal preservation while maximizing total return, you can think of that as something you're trying to balance. And effectively, what impacts the percentage you might have in equities is the time horizon over which you're measuring principal preservation. So, for example, if you said we don't want to lose any money for any 12-month period, that narrows things pretty tight in terms of what you could do in terms of equities. So we don't want to lose money over any 36-month period. That widens it out to where you can take a little more risk. When you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, if we look at ourselves in 4 years or 5 years, and there are certain things that are unacceptable, that's useful for us. So we can say, okay, if the time horizon is principal preservation over 4 years or 5 years, that starts to help us start to set parameters on risky assets versus risk-free assets. So that's why we're trying to get a handle on the parameters of what risk are acceptable and over what time frame.
Mr. Heidmeier.
I've got a question for Representative Weiner, who was instrumental in putting this together. And so when you look at the time horizon, when you look at the views that you shared with us, that you hope that they're not spending money in 2017, you know, as you put this together, what kind of period of time were you looking at for, you know, gradual withdrawals from this? I mean, I don't think you want to grow the fund just to grow the fund. At some point, I would guess you were thinking that you were going to utilize some of the dollars in there for future generations. But can you help me with some sort of horizon that you may have been contemplating at the time?
Yeah, I think my first child will graduate from high school in 2017, and that's why that date was set.
I knew.
Well, I think the purpose of the fund, you know, we always knew that the interest in earnings goes into the general fund. That's automatic. So the legislative body will have that much extra money to decide what their priorities are and where, you know, where they, and if it's $100 million, whatever it is, if it's, they will have that, and that will just automatically go into the general fund. Everybody that helped along the way, and there are many people that had a hand in this, I don't think the discussion ever came up that the 15% principal balance, what we should do with that, how should we spend that. The discussion the whole time was there should be a way to access some of the money if there is an emergency, something really bad happens, and we need money. And although you can't put that in the Constitution, but I don't, that's a good question. And I know I'm not going to answer it very well. I don't know the answer to that. I just know that we knew that the interest and earnings from this fund, for as long as the fund was active, hopefully many, many years, the interest and earnings would go back into the general fund, and the principal would continue to grow. And as the principal got bigger, the interest and earnings would grow as well. Every biennium, the interest and earnings, there would be more and more interest from the fund. I know there was some that talked about, well, you know, maybe it would be nice if somewhere down the road we were able to do like Alaska does. You know, or maybe there's something 10, 15, 20 years, 30 years down the road that we're able to do something along those lines. I don't know. Again, that's all going to depend on what future legislative bodies decide. But there was never really any discussion as to, you know, what should we do with it? There really wasn't. Another one of the reasons for this legacy fund was, you know, let's take some of this, because obviously the state's going through an enormous cycle where we're, you know, there's more money coming in every day, and it's wonderful to see. And there were some people that felt, you know, well, maybe we should try to set aside some of this money so that it all doesn't get spent now. You know, that was another one of the reasons for the legacy fund was, you know, there's a lot of people that are going to come along later in the state of North Dakota, and if things aren't as good in 20, 30 years as they are now, maybe we can help some of that by just having this large fund that would return interest and earnings to help, you know, better education or be able to keep up with, you know, the demands of education and whatever. So I didn't answer your question very good, but it...
That's
yeah, it was about it.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Dodson.
Along those same lines, that bill that got voted on by the voters and passed, we had it on the Senate side and the Tax Committee, and so this discussion was part of what went on in the committee. And a lot of that, the members of that committee, when they discussed this idea of how long is this money going to be in there before it's taken out, and what will it be used for, by and large, we felt comfortable leaving that unsaid, but that there was a feeling that the primary purpose of this fund would be, there would be a day in the future when we wouldn't have these kind of revenues coming in. There'd be several generations from now. We're not talking 10 or 20 years, we're probably talking 40 or 50 years, but there'd be a period of time out of the future when future generations would ask, why, what did they do with all the money? Where's it at? That this was sort of an intergenerational sharing of revenues to have these there. So when those future revenues are declining, that there'll be something there set aside. And that was kind of the general tone of the discussion. Not trying to assign a specific purpose for which it would be spent, but the idea that the future generation living in this state would have, in a time of declining revenues, there'd be something there.
Yeah, anytime you got mineral income, you have to.
Mr. Fong.
This is a question for the folks from RV Coons, and I apologize, I didn't get all of your names at the beginning. It's been a little bit hard for me to hear, but, and I hope you can hear me. I guess my question is going back to the core purpose of what it is we are asking you to do, and that is, it's my impression that you are going to be looking at the income piece of this, the spending piece of this, to come up with a recommendation for us as far as what our asset mix should be. And so, or our asset allocation, I should say. So I guess my point in bringing this up at this point is, while I tend to agree with others who have already spoken, that I hope that the entire 15%, which can be accessed by the legislature at some point, is not the approach they take. Don't you have to, in order to come up with this recommendation for us, kind of build that into your mix? And if that's the case, I mean, I think you probably have enough information from us now to know that's a potential. That doesn't mean that that's going to drive our ultimate decision in what our asset allocation ought to be, but at least you need to know that there's that potential. That's kind of, I guess, more of a, maybe it's a statement, but I think there's a question in there too as to, isn't that really what you need from us at this point in order to continue your work?
No, thanks for the question. When we do the modeling results that you'll see from us, there will be different scenarios that we'll show you. So to your question, which was a great question, you know, we will show you some data that shows what would happen if that 15% component, so beyond the interest and earnings, if beyond taking out interest and earnings, you did take the maximum 15% per every 2 years, what the impact would be on the market value or the corpus of those assets over time, would show what the impact would be if you didn't take that. So we will come back to you with some data to show the impact of different asset allocation options. Our objective today is to gather as much information as we can, as we're doing right now, from you. So when we come back with results, they're narrowed to a range of selections that would be feasible to you. It would make no sense to come back with something that's 60% private equity if that was completely beyond the realm of reasonableness. So a lot of what we're doing now is getting those parameters to narrow down the range of options that we'll be showing you.
An important part of this equation, though, because we've kind of gotten, I think, bogged down in
the very liquid part of it is what Ms. Sharp brought up, though, about whether some of this needs to be in equities, and going all the way back to our December discussion from last year when we made the decision to just invest in bonds in the meantime until we could figure this out further. My understanding then was that at some point we would have some equities in the mix, and I got the impression that you feel that way, Ms. Sharp, today. So I'm kind of directing it in the discussion to that point. Is there anyone who feels that equities should be completely off the table here? Representative Wilder does?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
I know what you meant. Go ahead.
I have a question again. Help me understand this. Do the equities bring a greater rate of return than the bonds? Is there a answer you can give me on that?
No, from your, one of the things we were going to talk about on the next page, Mr. Chairman, and is we're in an interesting time in that equity yields are about the same or higher than bond yields. So in historical terms, that's can be somewhat unusual. So the short answer to your question is over time we expect equity returns to be higher than bond returns. The other component to what you're considering now is I don't want to jump ahead too much, but how you're defining income and earnings. So if earnings includes both dividend income and interest income from bonds, then when you actually come down to building an investment portfolio, the types of mandates you look at may be influenced by that. So to make it more simple, you might like high dividend yielding strategies over like a normal index fund strategy. So one of our questions was going to be asking about just how you're viewing the earnings component of the portfolio.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that answer. I guess if I could just ask a couple more questions.
Go ahead.
Thank you. If this 15% is something that is needed, and so it's wise for this committee to make this money easily accessible, how soon? In other words, we're not talking about if I have money invested and I have some emergency at home and I need money. I understand that I can't get the money tomorrow, okay, because I have it tied up in, you know, whatever. This is government we're talking about. Government passes a law, and it's a minimum of probably, I think when we pass an emergency law, the law goes into effect July 1st instead of August 1st, or is that? I think it is.
It can be pretty much right away.
Okay.
As soon as it's signed.
Okay. So, again, this is still government we're talking about. So to have this money, to have it, 15% of it, accessible immediately, I question whether we actually need to do that or not. Again, we're talking about government. We all know how government moves. It moves very slow. So what is the time frame if we, and this may not be what we do, but let's say that we have nothing in cash or cash equivalent. How long does it take? Are we talking a week, a month, 6 months to be able to access?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's really two parts to the answer to the liquidity question. One is sort of the mechanical, what's the process for getting money and how quickly can we get it? The other component of that is what are the odds we'd have to sell something at a loss and how great would that potential loss be? You know, just comparing cash and short-term bonds, for example, you can get money out of a short-term bond portfolio virtually as fast as you can get money out of a cash portfolio. You're taking a little bit of interest rate risk. You're taking a little bit of credit risk probably, and the component of that is a slightly longer time period. But that's something that, you know, if we know that for the liquid piece of the portfolio, the worst case is we're going to need this money in 3 to 4 months as opposed to tomorrow, you might have a little bit more comfort in a short-term bond portfolio that may not give you a lot more than cash, but over time is going to give you something more than cash for that part of the portfolio.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and remember, if this state ever gets into a situation where we have to have the money tomorrow, we could always go to Eric and borrow from the Bank of North Dakota, couldn't we, Eric? My only concern, and everybody in this room certainly knows more than I do about how to invest and why to invest and where to invest, but one concern that I would have going forward is to be putting money into cash or cash equivalents for the specific purpose of making it available for the legislative body. I just have a concern over that because I have been one for 12 years. I know how they are. I know how things go, and I don't want the legislative body to have another reason to have another $150 million at their disposal immediately. So I think we're really talking about this money being available is in an emergency situation, because at this point in what this state's going through, I don't see us needing, again, I throw the number of $150 million out, but I don't think $150 million is really that big of a deal in this state at this point. So, well, I got a dirty look, Mr. Chairman. thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to ramble on.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kempinick.
Mr. Chairman and Josh, the definition of earnings, and that was something that we talked about. I think the idea is interest and dividend income is what would be classified as what would be available. You know, you can take that, but we've been talking because there really isn't a good definition of what, because gains, if you got to sell stuff to realize gains, that is not, I don't think, was the intent or the part of that discussion. I don't think that is part of, I think it was interest and dividend income. I don't think it was realized gains and stuff, appreciations and shares or whatever was part of what was going to be considered as available for that. I think anyhow, every discussion I ever sat in was more of what it earned, that you could lay, you know, that would be something above, if say you had one share and it earned out on interest of $1, that was what was available, not that one share you bought for $10 and went up to $15, it wasn't the $5 was available too. That you, because then you'd have to sell stuff to have a gain on it, and I don't think that was what was intended to, I think it was the income part of that or the earnings part of that was interest and dividend income is what I think was more of what would be classified as earnings.
Did you have a question or response to that? Or?
Mr. Chairman, this is moving ahead a little bit, but did have a couple clarifying questions around the definition of earnings. You'd be surprised.
Before we move on, though, let me just say, when I brought up thought of cash, you know, yes, a big part of it is because I do think that we have an obligation to have that money available if they choose to use it. But there's another factor in here that's just, I mean, that part of the discussion has overshadowed the other reason for having some cash in here. We all sound like we're pretty bullish here that, by golly, we can get out in the stock market and our economy is just taking off here. We're going to make a lot of money on these stocks and we can buy bonds, and heaven knows these interest rates are low. We're holding them down. those bond prices are going to go up, I'm not as confident as others seem to be in that. It might be that that cash, just holding its value, might be the best thing. And so I am maybe alone in the opinion that we ought to be keeping some of this money where there is little or no risk. Representative Wyler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have to step down from this committee now that you're...
Are you anxious?
No. That's just a question I have. I think you do, don't you? Okay.
We're figuring some things out.
Mr. Chairman, again, the Budget Stabilization Fund is purposely for budget shortfalls and problems that may arise, and it currently has almost $400 million in it. Mm-hmm. So if we talk about, boy, we have a problem and we need to access some money, that's the purpose of the Budget Stabilization Fund, and I believe that can be accessed without legislative approval by the governor or whoever. So again, that might be my last comments about this issue.
Until I leave or at all. but it doesn't go to the last point that I made, though, about, you know, are we so confident that all these other things are going to return positive results?
Mr. Chairman.
We do need to, you know, our agenda calls for, I think, at 4 o'clock for comments from the public. I don't know that we just want to wait till everything has been all hashed out and that sort of thing. So I'm going to open it now, right now, for a few minutes, and we'll come back to it again at 4 and we'll see if anyone who is here has any comments they want to make, and I know one of them does. And so we'll welcome her right now again, Treasurer Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to give you a little clarification. As it relates to earnings in government funds, the legislative process passed a law, I believe it was in 2007, which is called the Uniform Principal and Income Act, which defines earnings as it relates to government funds. So I would encourage you to take a look at that law as it reflects on this law in defining earnings relating to the legacy fund. In relationship to the challenges that you're discussing as far as cash flow, that's what we do. And working with the law as it relates to legacy fund requires our office to transfer 15%, to transfer the earnings at the end of the biennium from this fund, the legacy fund, into the general fund. Now that's what Connie does in the real office, is she makes sure as she's, instead of reinvesting or she's preparing to have those cash dollars available as it relates to the earnings, at which time that we can transfer them. Now, if there should come a time where additional dollars are necessary, it would be in the cash flow process that our office could try and accommodate. It's no different than we manage cash flow as it relates to the ebbs and flows of the Department of Transportation, for example. When they expend exorbitant amounts of money, we maintain more cash in the checkbook, per se, than investing it longer term with the Bank of North Dakota. So there are ways to work and manage cash within government to accommodate some of the questions that you're talking about without having to have immediate access in selling out stocks or bonds as it relates to that cash flow. And that's what we do.
The earnings that we're getting now don't go to the general fund, though, right? Until 2017.
The earnings are reinvested.
Here go back into the...
They're being reinvested into the fund, but always maintaining what is defined as earnings and income versus what retains and is added to the corpus. So that way, when the dollars are transferred from the legacy fund to the general fund, we have a clear line of what those two are and how much money gets moved.
But the earnings that eventually get transferred into the general fund are the earnings after 2017 or starting 2000. These earnings become principal, just like as if it was oil money, right? Anyone else have any comments? You rested up, Josh?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the brief rest. You know,
if anyone needs a break or anything, I would say just go ahead. Yes.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Cindy Turnus, and I am a State Investment Board designee. I would just like either Josh or Dan to address this board regarding the risks of leaving money in cash. I know they're much more well-versed than I am. Even though it feels safe, there's significant risk. So if it would be the board's pleasure to ask one of them to do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to address that?
You may.
The risk of too much money in cash is the opportunity cost, and when you have a very long-term portfolio like this that has as part of its mission preserving the real inflation-adjusted purchasing power, every dollar that's in cash makes that job harder. Cash doesn't do a very good job over long periods of time of preserving real purchasing power. And so that's the primary risk associated with too much in cash, is that it doesn't do a very effective job of preserving that purchasing power.
Well, you mentioned costs, so let's talk about costs a little bit. Of course, cash, there's not much cost involved with it. But, I mean, if we're going to keep any cash, it'll be a small percentage. These other investments, I think that you need to know some perspective that our board has on what our willingness are as far as costs of investing, too. So let's talk about that. And I don't know, you've worked with other groups. How's the best way to get that dialogue going? Everybody wants their costs to be low. But I think being a public entity as we are, I would expect that there's probably some sensitivity here, that the sky is not the limit on what we're willing to pay people to invest the money and do that kind of work for us. So I guess I'm opening it up at that point, but I think we should talk about costs of investing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, or Eric, or... Well,
Representative Kempinick.
Yeah. You know, that's one of the things in institutional investing, and it hasn't got on to that, but that's been one of the things, and this is coming from there's getting to be more and more of high-frequency trades, you know, to keep track, because there is such low, and how do you define, you know, because is it 1%? You know, you don't want to be cheap about it either, because that'll cost you money too on it. Is that something that you're going to have some parameters around how, because I know the more we're moving things, and that was one of the gentlemen we had here earlier here this year, was more of we weren't on it. Instead of just plopping it in, it was more following trend, you know, as a trend trader is basically what it was, you know, but then the costs are more higher. Is there mixes that can go into this, into scenarios like that? Or, you know, if you're going to spend more on costs, see that, because that does become a big problem too, because if you're spending out farther, is that something that you can help us with too on it, or?
Yep. Mr. Chairman, Representative Kempinick, one thing that I would sort of say is a kind of a take a step back on this is there's a priority of decision making that you go through as an institutional long term investor that really starts with asset allocation, and in that process, We're not trying to be too fine on, you know, the management costs associated with specific strategies that may eventually be a part of that mix. You know, we're really looking at net returns that we would expect from different asset classes, the risk of those asset classes, the correlation of those asset classes to each other. The next, and there's been a number of studies done, they're a little bit cliche, but they're true. They generally indicate that, you know, that first decision is going to drive 95%+ of the returns and risk of the portfolio. And it's a result of the way institutions behave. You know, we don't come in, you know, that's what institutions focus on is long-term asset allocation. If we were going to focus on coming in every day and picking, okay, stocks or bonds today, then it would be timing. That, you know, so it's somewhat behavioral, but, you know, it's the right focus because it's the most reliable long-term. The next order of decision-making is really, from our view, the next most important, and that's the structure within each asset class. So let's say we decide we're going to be in large-cap U.S. stocks, that's going to be part of the portfolio, whatever percentage. Then you've got some decisions to make around active versus passive, you know, the number and types of styles that you might invest in. And that's where that sort of focus on cost, I think, really comes in. But that's really kind of a next order decision, and not really as much of a component of the asset allocation decision.
What kind of, Mr. Chairhead and Jerry, what kind of, because I got Wyoming's, and this is of December of last year, but you're pretty, what's kind of their cost when you start looking at how they're ratioing, you know, how you got this ratioed out right now? It's kind of a 60-40, but you're fairly high in U.S. fixed on the one side, and then you go through the rest of it. What is kind of their cost on managing something like that?
Mr. Chairman,
I mean, just on
Kempinick, it's I almost hate to guess.
Yeah, well, that's what I meant.
But it's low. It's fairly low. I mean, with, you know, portfolios that large, you've got a lot of leverage to work to your advantage, and they use a fair amount of passive strategies as well, which helps to drive that down very low.
Chairman, again, this is John McLaughlin. One of the things that we could provide is, as part of our deliverable, is we do a biannually, we do a public fund benchmarking survey. And by asset class, I believe at the total fund level, that shows for a number of different permanent funds and pension funds across the country what sort of expenses they're paying, and we can express that as a range.
Mm-hmm. Well,
Representative Kempinick?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, and that this is a tough investing time period, you know, because and that's what makes it hard, because it, you know, when you look at, I've been kind of looking out over, you know, and I guess we basically got, while going now, we got about 4 years of that, you know, truthfully, cash isn't probably the biggest issue of our liquidity part of it. Mm-hmm. It's trying to maximize out what we're trying to do with it. And, you know, that's one of the things that I've been struggling with, and that's why, you know, I'd like to see, you know, some sideways, and I know when you did your presentations, you had, you know, you got your different models to run through and stuff on it, then if a person could see, you know, kind of what we've talked about today, had some different scenarios, kind of what we're doing today, you know, what we've got it in today, what, you know, what's kind of, you know, your Wyoming model, you know, and I mean, it's done well over the years, you know, right now it isn't doing so, you know, and it might have been, I haven't seen this last year's because it's been up for a while yet now and stuff on it, so, but it you know, that's the whole problem. You take these snapshots in time and try to figure out where we're going to be at in 4 years and stuff on it, and, but that's what it'd be nice, you know, something like that, and then have something even, maybe even more conservative or go on a different direction. I don't know how, you know, what you'd be looking at, some inflation-adjusted type portfolio that you could put together too or something. I don't know what, but I think that'd help a lot, and then try to figure out what's, and it's time. Time is one thing that we've got on one side. We've got a lot of time, because this is, it's kind of like what Representative Wyler, this is supposed to be a permanent fund. I mean, it's something that we shouldn't have to deal with, you know, and truthfully, as much, I know Representative Wyler doesn't, and the legislature does, can be a problem if it looks like there's something from God, basically, that, you know, that isn't earned and it's just available, you know, that it's a potential to get spent. I don't see the legislature changing hands that hard to where it could be accessed and just spent, but you never know, and that's the biggest problem where we're sitting today.
Of course, the legislature can be a problem, but I hope we have some pride in the fact that it's also the legislature that put this before the people to create this. And so sometimes it's easy to kick at government, but there's been some things we've done pretty well over the years, too.
Not bad.
Well, I hope.
Anything else specifically on cost? Mr. Hardmeyer, would you talk a little bit about what you learned regarding the Norwegians and their transition toward doing some tactical investing?
Wow, thanks for putting me on the spot. Well, as we talked about a few months ago, you know, the Norwegians and their model, and I guess we have some of that here. But what as I can recall is that, you know, the Norwegians, when we were there in June, had as a asset allocation a 60-35-5 model, 60% stocks, 35% fixed income, 5% real estate. Their monies basically started flowing in they set up their fund in 91, started flowing in 96, and now they have reached a level of funds of $638 billion plus, probably the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world. So, you know, that's the other part of it, and we've talked a little bit about here, is that they have set a benchmark of 4% of their funds or their earnings can be sent over to, you know, the equivalent of their general fund. So it would fund 4% of their general fund needs. That as opposed to the 15% that we're talking about here out of earnings. So, you know, that's quickly my takeaway from it. And I think what we had talked about here was questions about whether the 15%, you know, was hard and fast, whether that had to go to the general fund or whether that was a maximum amount, and that by choice or by desire, we could say, you know, wouldn't it be nice to choose a lower amount or not at all? Is it absolutely required that the 15% be transferred over? I think that was unclear. So there's a lot of different governance issues around it, but I mean, I think that was kind of the core of what they were doing is setting aside a certain portion of it and also realizing that that fund and that 4% at some point could represent such a large amount that you know, they would fall into a trap where they would, you know, as Dave is concerned about, overspending what they really need and just growing government and becoming you know, kind of nonchalant about their spending. So I think that is a concern, something that we should be thinking about, or they should be thinking about, is do you really need the 15%? Should it be something less? Could it be a recommendation that we make? Is it something that, you know, SIB needs to weigh in? I don't know, but that's kind of the essence of it.
Well, regarding the 15%, at this point, that's what the Constitution just is, and
it has to.
Yeah, it's
up to.
Not more than.
Right. I mean, I think every one of us agrees that we hope that it's zero in 17 and again in 19, but I mean, we can't just say, well, we're changing that down to 5, or up to 25, or... But what I was getting at, Mr. Hardmiller, were you here the day when John Lewis was here and spoke?
Sure he was.
He talked about tactical investing. And the Norwegian model does some of that. And ought we be doing some of our investing more tactically than what traditional models probably have? And that's what I was wanting to talk about at this point. I found his
well, no,
his philosophy, you know, it seems to me we ought to be looking at that possibility.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Kempinick?
Well, that's the whole thing, and I think that's what is kind of driving, you know, because when you got this pie and how we cut it up, you know, it doesn't go 100% in type of a, you know, tactical or trend, you know, where but I think we should have, you know, some avenues of where you got this slice available, you know, in a thought process. You got this here is fixed. You got the equities in this part. You got, you know, and truthfully, you know, right now for the next 4 years, I don't see why we'd even need a cash balance, probably per se. You'd have to have an investment though that would be that you could probably convert if we needed to, you know, and stuff on it. But I don't think that would be something that would be primary to start, you know, for the next, because I think the idea is here the first 4 years is to try to maximize out what we keep, you know, because we're going to keep putting more in. More than likely the principal is going to grow faster than any investment we got that we're going to put together. And I think that's the whole idea is to have that pie into some things and see how they, you know, I don't want to experiment per se, but I think that we want to have it where we're diversified out enough where we can see some things that, you know, and maybe there's some stuff that works within this as it goes forward, you know, a person, like you said, you're always revisiting this anyways and stuff on it to see if, but it's where at the end of the day, it's still a positive number. That's, I think, that is the biggest thing on it.
I'm only asking this rhetorically, but we keep talking about not needing cash, and we can always turn these investments into cash if they're needed, but have you tried cashing in your Enron stocks lately? Well, you can't get much cash out of something that's gone. But
Mr. Chairman, related to, and this is actually a point I was hoping to discuss as it relates to somewhat to the tactical discussion. One thing that we would recommend as you go through this process is to really try to separate long-term asset allocation decisions from the current environment, because there's really one decision, which is what's the right long-term mix for a portfolio like that has these competing goals of you know, generational equity and also some liquidity as might be needed. Because that decision can be made, but there's still this other component of how do we get from where we're at to that portfolio, and that's really kind of a separate set of decisions. And for example, I know from, you know, my experience with the state of Wyoming that it took a while to build that portfolio out. You know, they were first allowed to invest in equities in 1999. That was when their constitution was changed to allow that. And in hindsight, that was almost the top of the market. But you know, they were, you know, there was a very deliberate dollar cost averaging process that is prudent when you're adding risk to a portfolio. And so one thing that we would recommend is really trying to separate out what's the right long-term asset mix for this portfolio from current environment and how we get from point A to point B.
Do you feel you've heard enough from us to work on a asset allocation?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the conversation has actually been very helpful to help try out some issues and concerns that the advisory board has.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to follow up on your point on tactical asset allocation. It's a great point. We actually, when we're doing the modeling, we could include it's sometimes called multi-asset, sometimes it's called GTAA, which would be Global Tactical Asset Allocation. We can include that as an asset class. And you're correct that we are seeing interest, and typically it's an allocation of the portfolio. It's, you know, 5 or 10 or 15% of the portfolio, similar to what you were talking about. So that is something that we'll include in the modeling results.
Are we ready?
Mr. Chairman and Josh, just out of curiosity, is there a simple, easy answer to the question of the asset allocation in Wyoming?
Mr. Chairman, it's a fund that has some common characteristics with what you're building here. It's funded by some of the same, to a degree, some of the same natural resources, and has some similar, there's multiple funds there, but they have similar competing, and all investors have these competing goals of long-term return and preserving the real purchasing power and balancing that with the needs for near-term spending. One thing that heavily influences the process there, though, and I believe we'll hear, is considering the big picture and taking a step back and thinking about how this fund fits into the state of North Dakota and its economy. And to a degree, you're already somewhat economically sensitive because of the exposure to the price of oil. And we will spend a lot of time through this process, you know, really analyzing the correlation to that, because really, if you think about it, the worst case, you know, you have to think about what's really the worst case. The worst case scenario is really more of a deflationary environment where you've got falling energy prices, and that happens to be an environment where you've also got falling risk asset prices. So, you know, that portfolio is very much built as a long-term portfolio, and you see that it has risk assets, but there has been a degree of conservatism, if you will, that's been heavily influenced by that sort of big picture thinking, and you know, really thinking about how does this fit into, you know, the big picture for the state.
Did you have a follow-up?
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering, do they have a lot of money in equities? Is it over 50%?
Their statutes restrict the level of equities in their permanent funds at 55%, and they are in their permanent funds not all the way to that, but close to it.
Is that a common thing for institutional, for government investors to codify that kind of thing, as opposed to like what we have right now, where it's just sort of an adjustable committee or group decision, but not in law?
Mr. Chairman, with pension funds, no, that would be uncommon. With funds of this nature, some degree of codification is a little bit more common.
What would you say is the average amount that they put into code?
It's a difficult question to answer, because exactly what is codified is different in every state. You know, for example, an equity limit, in my experience, Wyoming's the only one that I'm familiar with that does that precisely. John, did you have something on that?
Mr. Chairman, we also work with the New Mexico State Investment Council, which is a permanent fund in New Mexico. They don't restrict the overall level of equities, but they do restrict within the Constitution the amount that can be invested with international equities, and that's 15% of their total fund.
So I assume they have built something in case of the good news scenario that, I mean, you're right at the limit, and the market just takes off on whatever's limited, but not on everything else, and so now all of a sudden, percentage-wise, you're high. I assume they have something built in, or do they have to quick sell something that's going up just really well?
Mr. Chairman, the rebalancing policy is actually overseen by the Treasurer's Office, and the statutory limit is on a cost basis, not a market value basis.
They let the Treasurer do that? For the record, just kidding around here.
Yeah.
let's jump to the spending questions you had, and I don't, unless everyone on the committee disagrees with me, I don't know that there's very much to talk about, because we don't have much to say about the spending.
No, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. And, yeah, I think our questions were more, we've actually clarified the questions that we had. Thank you for the definition of earnings and some of the details on how the spending might occur. We do have, you asked earlier, do we have everything we need for the modeling? One quick question that we don't have a specific, we haven't addressed specifically here. Are a couple of asset classes that we will include in the modeling if they're potentially of interest. You don't need to say at this point you definitely are interested, but if you're definitely not interested, it would be good to know. And a couple that come to mind are real assets, which would be assets that are more inflation oriented to protect value during inflation. And then we can also include real estate in the modeling. Real estate actually goes from publicly traded real estate to more illiquid real estate. But while we're
by more illiquid real estate,
more illiquid real estate would be like a typical real estate partnership where you own equity in individual properties.
Are we even allowed to do that? It seems odd to me that.
Thank you.
If we are, and I see nodding that we are, even within the state, so is it being suggested that we could take this money and go out and find some land that's at auction or a commercial building that's auction and go bid everybody up on it? I would hope not.
No. This, what we're listing of as institutional real estate partnerships where it's diversified across the country.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Because there's a lot of these mutual funds, you know, that are in, they got a portion of their portfolio in real estate, you know, and it's, there's
sure,
a lot of
right.
investors there. But there is states, they're investing in Iowa, Illinois, farmland, you know, I mean, there is, they are investing. North
right.
Dakota is a little tougher.
Right. So yeah, for today, the discussion was more if they can definitely would not be of interest, we won't include them in the modeling. If you're not sure, we'll include them, and you can address it later.
The one thing that I would only object to is if we started investing in things for social reasons rather than security or income reasons. I have zero interest in hearing that we're investing in solar panels because we want to save the polar bears or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Kampanek.
And I think, too, that goes along with the real estate part of that, too, that, you know, I think it's got to be some type of a commercial or some, you know, we don't want to be buying out somebody's Chase Lake deal, you know, or funding something that,
okay.
You know, I want to see it as a commercial venture if we do any type of real estate. I don't have, Mr. Chairman, you know, that's one of the things that's, you know, the inflation hedge is real when you do this, and even long, especially long term is more, and that's been, you know, been an ongoing discussion
right
along. Well, it even says it in there, and I don't know how else, you know, what's frustrating is land's kind of like gold, you know, you don't realize anything until you sell it, you know, you can buy it, but you don't, until you sell it, you really don't realize any gains and stuff on it. So it, but I wouldn't have a problem if we did some. I'd like to see what it is, but kind of what, how the mix, it doesn't look like it's very big, and most of these, I know.
That's right.
Alaska's isn't big, and they see they're about 4% in Wyoming, so.
Anything else on that? The last question, I don't really understand the question, what you're asking.
I'm sorry,
You asked, what do you foresee as our interim and final deliverables, and who will be the targeted audience? Maybe someone else can help you with an answer, but I don't know what question.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what we're talking about in terms of this is looking forward, the actual physical report. We often ask, should we expect a report? Will it go to just the board? Do you expect it'll be a widely disseminated report? Is there a format? Would you like to see an executive summary? It's more, are there preferences on the actual, you know, the makeup of the final report we produce?
What would you imagine the final report to look like? Are we talking about a 10-page thing or a 500-page thing? Or what do you think it?
We certainly hope it's not 500. That would be that would be painful. Typically, what we have is
for us too.
Yeah, it is an executive summary, so summary of the findings, and then, and Josh, feel free to weigh in. You've worked on these as well. There would be the actual modeling section of the report, which might be 10 to 20 pages or so, and then comments on the actual policy side. I don't know if you'd like to add anything to that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's probably more than 10 pages, certainly less than 500. You know, we very much believe in an executive summary up front that tells you, you know, what's most important. But, you know, typically we also, you know, we'll document the entire process, which could be, you know, could be 30 to 50 pages of material.
Well, you came and sold yourself as having experience doing these kinds of things and success, and the investment board hired you, so I'm confident that your deliverable product is readable and helpful to people. And beyond what you've explained, I don't have any suggestions or issues with that. Does anyone else?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kempinick, you want longer? Want it longer than 50 pages?
It's 200 pages.
Yeah, they'd really put everybody to sleep. But I do think it will be, if, you know, when we get, it will be, because we got a session coming up. And I know that the appropriations will want to see it. I'm sure the governor, well, they'll see it. You know, I mean, it'll be more than likely a widely distributed document. Mm-hmm. Because it isn't just this committee. We're just kind of the toe of, mm-hmm. of a lot of it. So.
Mr. Chairman, part of what we are getting at there is really, you know, we want to support you the best way that we can in this process, and I do know from experience that there's a lot of different stakeholders, and we're talking about some things that are related, you know, asset allocation and spending, but influenced by different decision makers. So to the extent that we might be helpful to you in presenting education on concepts to whether it's a legislative committee or other interested stakeholders, we just wanted to let you know we're really here to help you and support you in whatever way we can do that best. So.
No, I think that's kind of, and it probably will, you know, there probably will, as session gets rolling and if there's questions, and council will know about it, and I'm sure you'll be hearing about it.
Darren? Is there anything in the contract regarding, you know, how many copies of the report are going to be available or anything like that?
As many as needed. There's no restriction.
If you get it in electronic format, you don't need all the paper.
Yeah, that's going to be the best way to do it.
Well, but there's still some people who like to look at it on a paper copy and mark things up. I would think you're going to want some copies on hand at the Legislative Council and probably some copies at hand from the Investment Board, certainly for this committee, you know, so, and just hopefully you're able to make more if there's high demand for more, but, I mean, I think you're going to need 20 or 30 copies. Is that okay?
Mr. Chairman, when do we expect that report?
Well, next week is Thanksgiving, so I hate to do it that week.
Mr. Chairman, you know, the typical time frame for something like this is about 2 months from start to finish. We will work with you, though, to meet your needs as far as time frames.
Okay.
2 months from when? Today? Or when you sign the contract? Today?
We should be able to do it faster than that, though, shouldn't we? You've done these before. We're not that novel, particularly, are we, in our approach?
Mr. Chairman, we can certainly do it faster than that. Are there specific dates and upcoming meetings that are important from a timing standpoint?
Well, our legislative session starts right after the first of the year. Mm-hmm. So I think the more quickly we can move this along, mm-hmm. the better it is, because from the legislator's perspective, once that starts, it's just consumes every moment of your time. And so, and of course, the later in the session it gets, the more consuming it becomes. So I think the important thing is having a good product. But it's also important that we move it along as quickly as we can.
Understood. Okay. Mr. Chairman, one question related to that. I did hear a request earlier for us to present options. Would you envision an interim meeting at which we present sort of the first draft of the report, inclusive of multiple options, as a sort of interim step in this process before we actually are talking about delivering a final report?
I think, we hired you because the investment board felt they could rely on your expertise. If after you all have talked it over for a few days, if you feel that there are big questions, not whether it should be 59% equities or 62% equities, but big questions, then I think that we should be notified and it brought to our attention as quickly as possible, and we try and have a meeting help to clarify that and make some decisions. But if you think that what you've heard, and after you've digested this for a few days, as well as the turkey, and you think that your suggestions are clarified in your mind well enough that these are pretty obvious decisions, then we probably don't need to. So come to us if you have big questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Campanet.
Mr. Chairman, and committee, well, I think that I'm trying to figure out how to see, we're going to have to leave here today, though, if we're going to do that we're going to go with a mixed, we don't want to, we're going to go with just, I think that's probably what, if we're going to, the way it looks is that, I think, maybe, I don't know, should we take a show of hands of that to go with, with a mixed, because that's a change in what we've done, here a year ago.
I think we have all agreed that we need to do more than bonds. And that was our decision last year.
Yeah.
And this is the next step in that process of figuring out what that is.
Okay. Because that's what I was under the assumption that that's what we were going to do today, was get this moving on where, so. Yeah.
They're going to provide a suggestion, and then we're going to take action.
So I think that's what it is, and looking at the, that's the whole thing, is we've looked, I got the Alaskan fund up, I got the Wyoming fund up. There isn't a lot of difference when you start, Alaska's a little more aggressive than Wyoming is. I don't know if that's, but what you're doing in Wyoming is probably pretty close to what we're going to wind up doing. But I'm not saying we're going to, but I hope
we do better than Alaska. There was a lot of mad people there last summer.
Yeah. Well, no, but I'm just saying, there isn't a lot of room, you can within that, but if you're looking at what you're doing, that's why I said it's a hard investment environment, because right now, it's
there's some making, but none are making anything real big that you can't, if you got a loss in one asset class, isn't really making up ground for the others to, and have the fund stay positive, you know, with net returns anyways and stuff on it. It is.
I think we've kind of talked through the issues that you felt you needed guidance on. We'll open it up now for public comments, even though we're a few minutes early. I think we're close enough to four to consider it to have been on the agenda as advertised.
Mr. Chairman, my name's Howard Sage, and I sit on the State Investment Board. Been on the State Investment Board since 1988. And I've been through this process a number of times. And with all due respect, I think you're putting the cart before the horse. I think what R.B. Coons needs to know from you is what your goal is. And if your goal is to maintain the purchasing power of this fund, then it has to keep up with inflation. And what is your current inflation assumption?
Long term, it's 2.5%.
2.5%. So if it's 2.5%, then and that's your goal, you need to construct a portfolio that's going to earn 2.5%. And if you're satisfied with that, that's a relatively easy target. So if you're shooting for something more than that, well, they need to know that. If it's 2.5% plus 2, then they can construct a portfolio that will yield that. And that has a different mix of equities and fixed. So I think this committee needs to provide the guidance to them to that extent.
Okay. Thank you for your thoughts on that. The people from Coons seemed indicated they were comfortable, they had the guidance we need, that they need, and we've had quite a bit of opportunity to provide the guidance we wanted to provide, and we'll take care of this committee. And the investment board will take care of theirs. Any other comments?
No, I'm good.
Just in time. Go up to the microphone and state your name and tell us what we should do here. We got a half a billion dollars we need to invest. What's your name? Ben? Do you want to get on the record and have a few words? We're glad to have you here. Welcome to the Capitol and to our hearing. We're just about ready to wrap up. I hope that we don't disappoint you, that you wanted to watch for a while. You want to hear your dad talk in the microphone a little bit? He's had a lot of good ideas and has been a tremendous committee member and a tremendous legislator for a lot of years. And do you know what we're talking about today?
No.
We're talking about the Legacy Fund, and your dad was one of the key people that helped create it. And what we're doing is we're taking some of the oil money that's coming in, and we're saving it, because someday times might not be good as they are, and for future generations like you, or maybe your children or your grandchildren, thanks to your dad and others in the legislature and the voters around the state, we've decided to set some of this money away for some time when it's needed even more than it is needed now. And I hope you're awful proud of him. Good deal. Anything else? Thank you, everybody, for being here. We're adjourned.